Now here's Bill Resnick with Traven Lason. How do we stop the scourge of gun violence?
Hi, Traven. Welcome to KABU.
Hi. Great to be on with you.
Traven is a lefty for all occasions. He's very active in Vermont, president of the Green Mountain Labor Council. He's a longtime socialist and labor activist. He works with the single-payer campaign as well as the Vermont Workers Council movement, which is quite powerful in the state. He also hosts Equal Time with Traven on WGDR Radio, which is a standard commercial station in Vermont. It includes, of course, a lot of right-wingers who buy their way on. Traven is dueling with them frequently. And hosting interviews, you get some expertise on a lot of things and how our various struggles fit together within U.S. politics as a whole. So, Traven, you've written on gun control, how the left should address the issue, how we understand it, what sorts of demands we must make, and changes we work for. This coming Saturday, there's going to be marches all over the country, including in Portland, marches for our lives called by students, and what promises, of course, to be a huge march in Washington, D.C. My sense is that the left is going to be there, I hope, with leaflets and speakers and a message about how to stop school and other massacres, and indeed how to greatly reduce all gun violence in this country and violence in this country. You've been thinking about that a lot, Traven. Before, though, we start outlining our leaflet and our statement and what a left can say, let's start with the current moment. What's the significance of the current struggle over gun control?
I'm glad you started out with what's happening among youth. There's a context here. You've got our public school communities, that's the students, teachers, the parents, citizens in general. We've been seeing all of these public institutions targeted with deeper budget cuts. There's greater inequities in the system, harsher penalties for underperforming based on arbitrary testing standards, and now the rise in deadlier gun violence. So it's really no wonder that people are starting to stand up and say they've had it. They've had it with a lot of things, one of which is inaction on school safety. So you've got this March for Our Lives, which, you know, may have a million people expected to join that this coming weekend. This may be a deepening of a youth radicalization, which we've begun to see in recent years. I think we started to see that with Occupy. We saw it with the attraction of many youth to the Sanders movement. And now, you know, there's this critical issue of people not feeling safe at school, and rightly so. They raise the questions of gun control, which is a complex and difficult issue in the United States, more than anywhere else in the world, probably.
Oh, that's for sure. There seems to be one additional factor that comes into it. It's the NRA and its power over politics and politicians and its capacity, and the NRA's composition, which is basically a lobby for the gun industry. That was the historical funding of it, and still a lot of its funding and its drive is gun store owners and manufacturers. And I think everybody recognizes the NRA as an enormous detriment for this country, and the youth in particular. It seems to me, though, that implicates the entire way the economic system is now dominated by the various industries who are making this country so much more unequal and so much more violent. And that's a very powerful understanding to come to for 16-year-olds and younger.
I think where I might differ with you a little bit is I see the NRA as a very complex organization. It is a mass organization. Yes, it's a powerful lobbying organization for the gun manufacturers. That's where they get most of their money, most of their finances, more so than from their members. But, you know, they have at least 5 million members and probably another 15 million people who say they're NRA members who don't bother to pay their dues. And that's because they're also a service organization, which gives them a tremendous grassroots power as well as financial and political power in our state capitals and in D.C. Yeah, we're up against a whole gun culture there that has developed and become more brutal, particularly, I think, since the early 1970s, which I think is very much related to general sort of decline in insecurity in this country, which is why the gun control question should be seen in a broader context.
I think what you just said, though, deserves a little more comment, that, in fact, was the NRA at the top and in its political manifestations is just basically interested in selling guns, and to anybody, even doesn't want to have background checks or has fought against it, and any kind of gun, nearly, certainly assault rifles. But at the grassroots level, it's a lot of people who do like their guns and see they need them for self-protection or for feeling manly or womanly or able to deal with the society. It seems to me the gun is a symbolic object as well, and it performs a very important service for a lot of people and makes them feel more secure in a very insecure world. But those people, I think, are not, in fact, interested in just making profits from guns. And I think it's not impossible to erode their support. I agree entirely. Like all organizations in the United States, there's a complex membership of all kinds of complicated drives.
You're right. And I just, on a personal note, Bill, I should mention, I grew up as an NRA member, you know, and was a member. And yeah, I was a member for a long time until I, in the mid-70s, it became clear to me what their political trajectory was, which it didn't really represent my values anymore. But yeah, and you know, you and I, we both live in rural states, and you know, a lot of folks who I respect who belong to the NRA because they get proper weapons training, you know, they're hunters. But yeah,
there are other, though, gun organizations. Actually, the hunters broke off from the NRA when they went right wing. It's possible that the NRA could split. You see letters to the editor from people who value their guns and see them as sports things, and they like hunting, and they say, but the NRA does not represent me. At least those letters are now being printed.
Really?
Now back to the big issue that we want to talk about, which is how a left should be talking about gun control. There's a tremendous national conversation this coming Saturday. Of course, there's the march in Washington, D.C., which could get up to a million people. Who knows? They stopped counting. And they're demanding action by every level of government. There's also going to be a march in Portland, incidentally. We should announce it, with students, called by students. It's next Saturday, which is the 24th. Coincides with the march on Washington, actually. It starts at 10:30 and Terry Schrank Plaza and winds around a bit to get to Pioneer Courthouse Square. Anyway, back to, though, the question of how we should be talking to people, that is, KBU Radio and the Old Mole Variety Hour, certainly. The question for the left and Equal Time Radio with Travin, how do we enter that conversation? What should we say? Leaflets and statements and family discussions. How do we stop the massacres? But then it seems to me we have to ask the question how to greatly reduce all gun violence. Let's do an outline of the things that really have to be said now.
Well, I mean, I think we need to start out solidarizing with the students and at the same time laying out a position, as we understand it, on the real causes and cures of U.S. violence. And I think we've got to be clear that those are very much related to, the real causes are related to, the problems of poverty and inequality and alienation that underlie gun violence. Frankly, there's the question of the police in this society, which should not be ignored. The militarization of the police and the whole context, particularly, I think, since the Vietnam War, really the brutalization of millions of people in the United States, and this is, what, just now the 50th anniversary of the massacre at My Lai, where you had U.S. troops entering a neutral village, killing something like 500 people, mostly women and children. That came home very much in the late 1960s, and you saw the rise, together with, you know, opportunistic politicians emphasizing you know, white fears about black rebellions in the cities and crime. You saw the tremendous acceleration in the buying of guns, particularly handguns, in the United States, and the rise of more and more violence, gun-driven violence. That's a real change in gun culture in the United States, beginning with, you know, the Vietnam War, and of course wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and all of that only continues to deepen that gun culture and that violence that's brought home.
Yeah, let me state a hypothesis. My sense is that right now in the United States, the entirety of the working class, which is, what, 80%, 85% of the people who can be considered as sort of wage workers without wealth or proper or real big property. Certainly it can't live independently of their monthly or bimonthly check. There's a great fear and growing fear, it seems to me, of destitution, actually. People lose, you know, jobs are no longer a lifetime. Mm-hmm. People are extremely insecure. They have big mortgages. They have all sorts of expenses. Their kids want to have a good life, and how are they ever going to afford college? And that goes way up the ladder. And many of them, of course, can't afford college and realize they're in an underclass forever, unless one of the kids somehow manages to break free, which is happening less and less in this society. There used to be a lot of social mobility, not very much anymore. In any event, the precariousness of life creates fear, and yet that fear can't be channeled into fighting your boss because, of course, you're dependent on the job. You can't. For a lot of people, they're stuck in whatever place they live, and they have to maintain not just their job, but they have to keep businesses in their community or face the Rust Belt and desolation. So people are not blaming, my hypothesis is that instead of blaming the powers that be and the corporate apparatus and its elites and the banks and the financial system that is just draining off the economy, draining the blood of the people, really, that old metaphor, it seems to me instead of that, they're very vulnerable to this fear that's created, the fear of immigrants. They're the ones who are doing it. It's those blacks who are ruining our economy. The whole right knows that the reason there was this huge financial collapse in 2008 was the requirement on banks to stop redlining black areas. That's their theory. It was blacks and liberals who are destroying this country and destroying them. Mm-hmm. They're very vulnerable to those ideas. I think in some ways, owning a gun is therefore a way of finding security. At least when they break into my house and try and kill my family, I can shoot back or something like that. And I think it's a displacement, a horrible displacement of fear. I'm not sure that may be too absurdly psychological, but I have the sense that that's happening now, that it's a response by people.
Well, Bill, your sense is actually validated by research that's been done. There's a book by Jennifer Carlson, Citizen Protectors, the Everyday Politics of Guns in an Age of Decline. And what's clear, this is something that's particularly impacted men, where you used to have stable jobs, and particularly there were lots of good union jobs in certain parts of the country where you had strong unions. You could have the man could be bringing home the money and supporting an entire family. Now you have two paycheck families. People are struggling. They don't know what's going to happen in the future. There's tremendous insecurity, particularly since the most recent Great Recession. And men frequently, you know, their masculinity is men, am I? Hey, I'm a guy. I'm that demographic, is threatened by the fact that we're no longer the provider for the family. So the studies indicate that one of the ways for feeling better about your own self-image is to become like the protector of your family or the protector of your community. So you go out, and particularly handguns. That this is where the tremendous growth in guns is, and the tremendous growth in terms of deaths in this country. It's primarily handguns, not assault weapons. And of course, it's suicides, particularly among white men. I think in Vermont, for example, 89% of gun deaths in recent years have been suicides. I mean, that says something about the tremendous despair and alienation that exists in white rural communities. So you're on to something. This is very much about the age of decline.
And those are the suicides by guns. There's probably just as many suicides by drugs, drug mm-hmm. overdoses, or unintentional suicides with a lot of sort of deep unconscious motivations. This is KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Traven Lation. Traven is host of Equal Time Radio in Vermont. It's a big commercial station. Traven's been an activist in a variety of movements and especially knows gun control. In fact, was an NRA member in his youth, came from those roots. We've been talking about gun control and how to stop massacres and greatly reduce gun violence. And some of it, of course, is we haven't gotten to all of the details of it basically we're in support of the students and in support of their demands, like banning assault rifles and bump stocks and all of that sort of stuff. Of course, background checks and then more mental health care and schools, and I suppose stop school bullying, which seems to me amongst it. It seems to me we agree that those are good demands, but we went much further in this conversation into the fact that really the economy and culture of this country have to be changed, and there's possibilities of doing that. Why don't you have comment on that? Then we can get back to the problem of police that we do not have an answer to, but we really, really have to mention in this whole context. So first, say a few things about standard responses that are being demanded now of the legislators and being resisted by the NRA, and then we can get to the problem of police.
Well, we do need reasonable limits on the type of firearms that are available, and also restrictions on the ability of people with a history of violence and threats of violence to have access to them, and I think you've laid out some of those and the correct demands that students are making. But, you know, we also have to talk about, and this is controversial, but the demilitarization of the police and, frankly, demilitarization of our public schools. You have armed police and others in what, 30% of public schools already. It's being advocated now that there be more guns in the schools. And that's what we see is where that's already happened. It just means that more kids are being thrown out of school, and you've got the school-prison pipeline operating more efficiently. I think we need to get both the NRA and ROTC, ROTC, out of our schools. And most, you know, really most important, and we have to make the links here, there's got to be full funding for social service programs in the schools, training counselors, school psychologists, and dealing with the fundamental problems in this country by pressing the demands for things like a 15-hour minimum wage and other anti-poverty measures, a socialized healthcare system, maybe beginning with single payer, that would provide the kind of mental health care that would help in a saner, less violent society. These are all things which have to be part of the conversation.
And now let's get to the need for new kinds of policing. And that's underlined by the immense expansion of police forces and power with Homeland Security and border security, more and more private and public police, some of them without weapons, but most of them with weapons, and ever more powerful weapons being supplied by the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice. It's looking more and more like a national police force, and that allied with the Army. It seems to me that's a terrible, threatening possibility in U.S. life.
We see in this country, I mean, we see that from the Trump administration. We see cultivating it by the fight of relationships with the military, the actual organization of far alt-right militias that are well-armed. And, of course, reaching into the police department, actually infiltrating both the police and the military. So the right wing has a long-term strategic, I would say, fascist appetite to be able to use violence against movements, social justice movements, particularly immigrants, black communities, Latino communities, and ultimately the labor movement. So we should be concerned about that, and we've got to be thinking about how we both, I mean, there's a question of self-defense, which has to be taken seriously on the part of social justice movements. That's always been true within the black movement. And the way that gun control has been enforced in the past in this country has always been racist. I mean, quite frankly, you see it's over four times the number of black people that are locked up in relative terms than the white people for carrying guns, even though they have legal permits to carry them. That's the way gun control has been enforced in this country. So there are serious questions of self-defense, also concerns about the cultivation of a fascist fringe within the military.